come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love it.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank. Welcome back. I'm your host, Bill Frank. Nuclear power is the red-headed stepchild in the American energy puzzle today. The abundance of inexpensive oil and gas has sort of moved nuclear energy to the back burner. So what is nuclear energy's fate? Is it the missing piece in the clean energy revolution? My next guest believes that nuclear energy deserves a better fate than it's getting today. She is the president of the American Nuclear Society. Dr. Michelle, she goes by Mikey, Brady Rapp, has been an active member of the American Nuclear Society since joining in 1985. Dr. Brady Rapp is a chief engineer with the Nuclear Systems Design, Engineering, and Analysis Group within the National Security Directorate at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington. She has more than 25 years of experience in nuclear and criticality safety for plutonium processing and spent fuel systems. She got her master's in science, bachelor's in science, and her PhD in nuclear engineering from Texas A&M University. Joining us from the state of Washington, Mikey, welcome to the show. How are you today?
How are you today?
I'm terrific. Thank you so much for being our guest. And I want to dive right into it because nuclear energy really has fallen off the radar screen for most Americans today. With oil prices down near about $70 a barrel and sort of the renaissance of oil and gas industry in the United States because of shale oil and gas, plus what we're beginning to see is a slowdown worldwide in demand for energy, how can nuclear power compete with all of these headwinds?
You get into energy economics, it's a pretty complicated world, especially for people like me who are mostly science and technology. But I think the most important thing is to make sure we're looking at these different energy sources on an equal basis. Most notably, you know, in nuclear, we have high construction costs, high capital costs up front, but the cost of fuel is virtually nothing almost. And with other energy sources, you have the reverse.
Well, let's talk about that, because processing of oil and gas is pretty expensive. I mean, refineries are not cheap. How does the cost of a refinery stack up, say, against the cost of creating a nuclear reactor?
I think a lot of it is in the licensing and the interactions with the regulators, not so much the physical construction itself. So there's a different metric for safety, and there's a different metric for public interaction and interface and environmental impact and so forth. So I don't think that everything is exactly on an equal basis.
All right. Well, we'll come back. I want to explore that a little bit more deeply if we can. But I think the 700-pound gorilla in the room that we need to talk about are some of the nuclear power black eyes that we've had over the last few decades. I mean, most notably, of course, there was Chernobyl back in 1986, Fukushima Daiichi back in 2011. That's very fresh in people's minds. And by the way, you were instrumental in explaining some of what was going on there. And here in our own country, there was Three Mile Island way back in 1979, if people can remember back that far. So how will the nuclear energy industry overcome these setbacks to regain the public confidence?
I think those are all examples of where we've actually learned from our history. I think that's one of the things you'll see that is enforced by the NRC and the way the nuclear industry is regulated. When something happens, we take a really hard look at it, and we look for what we can do to prevent, you know, those things from happening again. You see it not so much in the United States with Chernobyl, because we don't actually operate that type of a reactor in this country. Three Mile Island, you saw some changes that came in with respect to monitoring. And Fukushima Daiichi has been full press by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to identify some backfits and different things that our power plants could do. So I think when you take a look at everything we're doing and the way we're communicating with the public what we're doing, and you take a look at some of the recent public opinion polls, in the United States, public support for nuclear is up in the 60%. I think that the American public is fairly confident that the industry and the regulators do all that they can to make it continue with its record as being a safe and efficient form of energy.
All right, well, let's talk about regulation if we can, please, because obviously that's critical to the overall process. I mean, we're dealing with, you know, spent reactor rods and things like that, which can potentially be very damaging to human beings and the environment as well. But I want to get down to it, because you mentioned earlier on in our discussion about the regulations on oil and gas industry are different than the regulations on the nuclear industry, and the NRC, or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, presides over all of that. So if you will, break it down for us. In what ways are the regulations here in the United States helping the nuclear power industry, and in what ways are they hindering the nuclear power industry?
The United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission is probably the gold standard internationally for nuclear regulation. And I think that's basically the way that they help us. They set people look to them, to how they set standards. We comply, and so I think that the NRC is great for the nuclear industry in the United States because of that gold standard, and I think sometimes we just feel a little over-constrained, but in the end, I think it's good for us, and it keeps us on track, and nuclear energy remains one of the safest and most efficient methods for producing carbon-free baseload electricity.
Well, now you say you feel a little bit constrained, and that's an interesting comment. In what ways is the regulation in this country maybe stifling the growth or the progression of nuclear energy power generation?
Well, for instance, I don't know if you've heard about these small modular reactors that people are talking about that have a lot of potential to bring power to remote areas and so forth, like in Alaska or somewhere like that. And we haven't yet been able to work with the NRC and establish how we would do environmental siting and regulation of those smaller reactors, and you know, basically a one-size-fits-all might not be the best approach, and certainly not one that leads to economic motivation for using small modular reactors.
That brings up an interesting point, because not all nuclear reactors are the same, and I'd like you to do a little compare and contrast for me, if you will. Not that my audience is going to understand the differences between these plants, but I want to take it back to 30,000 feet and look at the United States versus France. France leads all industrialized countries in nuclear power. They generate 73% of its power from their 58 nuclear reactors. Now, interestingly enough, the United States has more reactors. We have about 100 of them, but they only produce 19% of our electricity coming from nuclear. So give us the reasons why France can produce 280% more of its electricity from nuclear with fewer reactors than the United States.
See, when you start looking at percentages, it becomes a numbers game unless you recognize that the absolute value of energy used in the United States per capita is much larger than that used in France. And so we require more energy. Our population uses more energy, and that's the basic difference. Their plants are also pressurized water reactors, which are mostly what we have here in the U.S., and they're really about the same size. They're, you know, about they're new, right around 1,000 megawatts electrical.
All right, so there's no real difference between the reactors we have here in the United States and those in France, because I'd heard the ones in France are smaller, easier to build, and easier to operate. Is there any truth to that?
I don't believe so. They use the standard PWR design that was derived from the United States Westinghouse-type reactor.
Okay.
Now they have their own designs, but they're same size, same operating principles, same basic physics. The big difference is simply how much electricity we use and our standard of living here in the U.S.
All right, so we need more energy than the French do. That is very true. I thought perhaps some of it may have come down to the fact that France does have an energy plan, an energy policy for the country, and the United States really doesn't. I mean, with all the oil and gas that we've got, the nuclear, the wind, the solar, all of that, we really lack a comprehensive national energy plan. In what ways is the United States suffering because we don't have such a plan?
I'm so glad you brought that one up because, you know, my job is not... My day-to-day job outside of the American Nuclear Society is in research and development within the National Laboratory System. So from our end, what we see is constant competition on research in all these different areas. Everybody's competing for the same dollars. If we had a comprehensive plan that put a certain amount of emphasis on each of these different types of energy sources and had some projection as to when we're going to develop the next type reactor and, you know, when we're going to go eventually, you know, sometime in the future to electricity generated from fusion. And I think that we could do a better job of using the monies that we have to support innovations in a stepwise fashion instead of sort of a research and development free-for-all.
I like that, a research and development free-for-all. It has such an image, it connotes such an image in my mind. But I see it that way. I do see it sort of being a battle and hoard situation, that you're battling for the money and then you hoard it once you get it, rather than thinking about the bigger good. What prevents us from having a national energy plan, do you think?
You know, I just don't think there's the political will to do it. I think that, you know, there are so many special interest groups in the United States, and, you know, we can't all sit down and say, okay, you know, really the best thing for the country is a all-of-the-above energy policy, but all-of-the-above is not an energy policy. So everybody has a seat at the table, and we just need to see what makes the most sense. We need to have specific carbon goals because we need to know if clean energy is really important to us or if it's just something we're going to talk about. And then where along the way do we want to be and hold ourselves accountable to? So I think mostly it's the fact that we have a four-year planning cycle based on the way our politics work in this country, and we really don't have the political will to reach across those lines long enough to do what's best for the country.
My guest is Dr. Mikey Brady-Rapp. She is the president of the American Nuclear Society. And, Mikey, I want to bring it back home closer to us. I mean, you're up in Washington State. We're down here in California. California has two aging nuclear power plants, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon. Now, both of them were built near fault lines here in California. I'm not even going to ask you about whether or not that was wise planning. But San Onofre is petitioning the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to decommission the plant. So if so, what's going to happen to the spent nuclear fuel rods? This is an area of expertise for you. And in what ways does decommissioning a nuclear plant like this pose environmental hazards?
So one of the first things they'll do is defuel the reactors, and that'll go out and it'll go into a pool where it needs to cool for about 5 years. So there's one that's part of the reactor and a gulch of the reactor. And as soon as it's been cooled for 5 years, that fuel will go into a dry storage cask. And then generally what's happened in other plants decommissioned in the U.S., those dry storage casks are stored there at the site as they complete decommissioning of the plant. We don't right now have in the United States a disposition pass for that spent fuel past that temporary storage. So what we've done is established a safe way to deal with the disposition of the fuel until the government can make some decisions based on a geologic repository or an interim storage facility.
I see. All right. Well, let me ask this. I mean, this is a little bit of a divergence of my thinking, but lately you've seen in the news a lot of concern about Chinese hackers hacking into various government agencies. I think they've successfully hacked into 4 U.S. government agencies at this point. And because nuclear reactors have this fusion material that is so dangerous and potentially catastrophic, let's talk about the safety concerns of these power plants. I mean, how susceptible are they to these hackers, whether they're Chinese, Russian, wherever the hackers may come from? And what sort of threat does hacking pose to the public at large through these nuclear facilities?
I think there's been some artistic license taken from Hollywood in this area because one of the things that we focused on for a long time in nuclear is the difference between analog and digital controls. And we've made some movement towards digital control systems, but we've also been very, very aware of cybersecurity issues. So there's really no connection from inside the plant to the outside world, like to the Internet or something. So actually being able to get in and remotely impact the control systems at a nuclear power plant is not something that can be done. And as we go through our accident analysis, part of the way we design in safety, we design in for accidents where something stops working. for instance, and we put in recovery times and so forth for the plant staff to come in and deal with that. So I think it's a pretty robust safety analysis that we do, and we take extreme measures to make sure that there's no direct access from off-site to any of the control systems in a nuclear plant.
That'll put a lot of people's minds at ease. My guest is Dr. Mikey Brady-Rapp. She is the president of the American Nuclear Society. And Dr. Brady, I'm going to change direction if I can here for just a minute and ask you, why do you do what you do? I mean, of all the things, you know, you went into science, technology, mathematics, STEM research. You became a nuclear engineer, literally. And why? Why do you do what you do?
Number one, I think that the whole concept of nuclear energy is fascinating. You can get so much power from something you can't even see, and it has so much potential to do good, you know, across the world, increase the standard of living for people, you know, bring electricity and energy to people who haven't had it before. And I think it can all be done safely, since that's my specific background, is the nuclear safety piece, something we're very conscientious of. And I hate to see the world miss an opportunity to have that standard of living for a lot of its population, protect the environment at the same time it has that standard of living. And it just seems like we'd be doing humanity a disservice if we didn't engage and participate and try and inform people so they can make decisions about how they want their lives to be.
Wow, that is very great. My guest has been Dr. Mikey Brady-Rapp. She is the president of the American Nuclear Society. And if you've piqued the interest, Mikey, of some of my listeners, they want to learn more about you, maybe learn more about the American Nuclear Society, where would you direct them to go?
We have a great website, which is our Center for Nuclear Science and Technology Information. That's www.nuclearconnect.org.
NuclearConnect.org. That is great. Mikey, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.